Barbara, I assume that was worth the trip from Arizona. If you have not been present in the past few weeks, it might help to know that we are in the middle of a series of sermons on what it means to love in the way Christian scripture uses the word agape. We are reading the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians in depth, and we have stopped for a while on a single line in that chapter which says, love looks for a way of being constructive. We have reminded ourselves over and over that the New Testament word for love has nothing to do with romance or physical infatuation or friendship or family love. It is not a matter of emotion, but a matter of willpower and determination. It has nothing to do with whether you like someone. In the New Testament sense, you can love a person you do not like, and you do it by treating that person the right way, regardless of how you feel. If you keep that definition of agape love in mind, what comes next, I hope, may make some useful sense to you. Do you remember the game we played in childhood? He loves me, he loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not. The years drop away and I see my sister and myself walking home from school, pulling the petals off a flower or twisting the stem of an apple to see on which phrase we would be forced to stop. It was a harmless little fantasy, acted out when we were still too young to date, but were beginning to think about it. We won the game, of course, more often than we lost. We learned how to manipulate the twisting and the plucking. But for some people, the flower petal and apple stem game doesn't ever come out right. Do my parents really love me? The little boy wondered last night. Not in words, but by screaming out in different ways to get attention. If he doubts that they do, it becomes even more important to wonder when he goes to school, does my teacher love me? Do my playmates love me? Children like this often grow up into men and women who are still asking, mostly in subconscious ways, if they are loved. If they think they may not be, they tend to misconstrue even kindly remarks and to wonder if the laughter over in the corner is directed at them. The truth is that we are all stem twisters and apple pluckers. We keep testing our world and feeling out our associates to see if they think we are lovable. If we are intelligent and sophisticated, we do it skillfully. But people trained to read personality can see through us. Dr. Paul Tournier, a Swiss psychiatrist, speaks of a letter he got from a very distinguished man with this line in it. Everybody esteems me, but no one loves me. It is the grown-up cry of an anxious child who needs to feel loved to be completely happy. I haven't forgotten our biblical text from the Apostle Paul when he said in the Corinthian letter that the greatest thing in the world is love. He gave as one of his reasons that love creates people. It begins with the beginning of life at home, with the first shaping forces we know anything about. I filed away an odd legend years ago. Two paragraphs from a Life magazine article. They read like this. The medieval writer, Salim Benet, tells of an experiment conducted by Frederick II, Holy Roman Emperor and King of Sicily, in the 13th century. He wanted to find out what kinds of speech and what manner of speech children would have when they grew up if they spoke to no one beforehand. So he bade foster mothers and nurses to suckle the children, to bathe and wash them, but in no way to prattle with them or speak to them, for he wanted to learn whether they would speak the Hebrew language, which was the oldest, or Greek, or Latin, or Arabic, or perhaps the language of their parents of whom they had been born. But he labored in vain, the legend says, because all the children died, for they could not live without the petting and joyful faces and loving words of their foster mothers. Some of that, of course, is nonsense. Hebrew is not the oldest language, and not all children are going to die of neglect. But the legend has some truth in it, and the Life magazine essay goes on to make its own point. And I'm quoting, 700 years later, it says, a whole series of studies of children raised in institutions, such as foundling homes and orphanages, without the petting and joyful faces and loving words of their mothers or foster mothers, confirm the conclusion of the medieval chronicler. Infants who receive nothing more than routine physical care don't, of course, inevitably die, but they are slower to reach in almost every significant milestone of child development, the place you want for them, whether physical, social, or intellectual, and they are vastly more prone to grow up with serious emotional problems which progressively stunt their growth and limit their potential. So writes the contemporary author, and beneath that rather formal statement lies a hard, cold truth. People cannot become fully human without love. Esteem is not enough, the famous man told his doctor. I want to be loved. And a child who grows up without love may survive, but she will be crippled, often in ways she will not herself recognize. I have an old anthology of poetry at home, which I have always thought was the most important single book I discovered in my junior year in college. It was called Modern British Poetry, and there were three of us who used to sit up till 3 or 4 in the morning reading Hardy and Houseman, Yeats and Bridges aloud to one another. There is a line in that book that made me feel the force of an idea as I had never felt it before, and I find it as provocative this morning as I did that night in the dorm when I first saw it on the page. The poem is called Germinal, and its whole point is that things that happen to us early in life are of enormous significance. The poet thinks, whether rightly or not, that Dante, with his great vision of heaven and hell, and Caesar, with his dream of world conquest, were all foreshadowed in the way their souls were shaped in childhood. And then he writes the lovely line that struck me so forcibly, and that I think life has authenticated over and over since. In the lost boyhood of Judas, Christ was betrayed. What Judas became, we would understand if we knew everything about those vanished years when he was a child in need of being created by love. The plant was in the seed. In the lost boyhood of Judas, Christ was betrayed. It would be a terrible thing to say to parents if they were the only ones who shaped their children's lives. It is frightening enough just to think how much we determine character by how well and how wisely we love them. In a book by Lisa Richette called The Throwaway Children, there is a story of a 15-year-old boy who killed a 3-year-old neighbor girl with whom his own sister had often babysat. He had seemed a model child, so the whole city was shocked when this happened and searched for answers. The best one came from an unexpected source, the little girl's father. In an open letter to the people of Philadelphia, he spoke of the terrible grief which had shattered his life, of the purity and joy of his child, of her being to him the most precious gift life had ever given. And then he went on to speak of the boy who had killed her. What he implied in his letter was that the son was a model child, not because he wished to be, but because he had been forced by a rigid and unloving set of parents to keep every genuine emotion repressed, or they would not love him. He had learned to perform like a machine to their satisfaction, but deep underneath, sensing no genuine love from them, he was hostile and waiting for a chance to hurt someone else, some helpless person, as he himself had been hurt. Beware, citizens, the grieving father wrote, the human animal cannot be cheated forever. It will have love or kill. I cry out to you to take better care of your children. He did not mean that they should never be crossed or denied anything. He only meant be sure they know in both praise and blame that they are loved, and there are ways to show that. One summer afternoon, years ago, I came home from the university to find police cars and curious crowds all over my neighborhood. I knew one of the policemen, and he shared with me what would be announced a few hours later that the older boy of two sons, both of whom I knew, was the prime suspect in the brutal murder of his own mother and father, whom I also knew. The neighbors were shocked because the family had seemed so respectable and well-mannered. The house was neat. The parents spoke politely to others and worked hard and lived exemplary lives to all public appearance. But there was another side, something missing in that public picture, and I had some knowledge of what it was. The boy charged with that murder was dating a young woman whom I had watched grow up. His parents objected. She belonged, they told him, to the wrong church. So they hounded and harassed him until finally they broke up the romance. Except that he could not forget and kept showing up at her house, if only to talk for a little while with her mother and father. I think the boy would have survived that disappointment, many children do, if something else had not been missing from the earliest years of his life. Relatives and friends told me, when we talked of the double murder, that the father, supported almost always by his wife, perhaps through some fatal flaw in his own childhood, was incapable of expressing love and tenderness and admiration. A man who lives near me had invited that father to referee a basketball game one night, a game in which the sons of both fathers would be playing. When he came back that evening, my neighbor said, vehemently, never again. The man he had invited shouted criticism and abuse at players, at his own son, in ways that embarrassed everyone, including the two boys who were playing together. On another day, my neighbor took that man's son to play golf with his own son, and out on the course, they ran into the other boy's father playing with a group of his friends. He called to his son, "Come on over here and play with us." The boy said he wanted to stay where he was. My neighbor, who is a considerate man, said, "Don't you think you ought to go play with your father's group? He wants you to play." To which the boy replied with intense emotion, "No, I don't want to play with him. I won't do anything right all day. I never do anything right for him. All he'll do is tell me how bad I am. I want to stay here." Later on in high school, the boy seemed to work hard at times to get approval, went out of his way on occasion to be helpful, but also had inside himself a reservoir of repressed rage by that time that could explode and terrify people. The friend of mine who knew him in high school said he did not initiate fights, but on the rare occasions when he got into one, it would take several people to pull him off his opponent. There was so much hidden resentment, such a long-standing and desperate hunger for whatever he was missing in life, that when the barriers went down, all reason went with them, and he became a wild animal, taking vengeance on a world he felt had cheated him. Do you know what a difference it might have made if on just a few nights his father had been able to put his hand with a kind of rough, masculine tenderness on his son's head and say, "I am proud of you, son, and I love you." Even if he could not have managed to say such a thing, there might have been adequate substitutes, a look in the eyes, the touch of a hand, some indirect comment the child could decode and feed upon. But this father, by every account, was much too busy to share such moments. I wonder whether he was himself a victim, still working out frustrations from lack of love in his own childhood. I'm not sure. All I know is that the years passed while his son waited for the word and the touch of love until one dark summer night it became too late. It isn't only children. Someone may need desperately your love and approval this week. Someone whose very survival may depend on the word you speak or the touch of your hand. Don't miss the chance.